Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Diseases spread by mosquito, flea, and tick bites tripled in the U.S. between 2004 and 2016. That's according to a report from the Centers for Disease Control earlier this month. Ticks are largely responsible for the increase, and Lyme disease makes up 82% of the illnesses caused by tick bites. But there still are diseases being spread by mosquitoes, including some that haven't occurred here in the United States. On today's program, we discuss the increase and what can be done about it. Our guest, Tim Abbey, Penn State Extension Educator, Horticulture Green Industry. Dr. Abbey, thank you very much, or I should say, Mr. Abbey, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Good morning. Yeah, I'm not a doctor.
I was giving you a promotion right off the bat. It's an honorary thing. Also joining us is Tom Smith, Mosquito Surveillance and Control, Pesticide Education and Community and Citizen Engagement. Mr. Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And both our guests are based at Penn State York. If you have a question or a comment relating to flea, tick, mosquito bites, disease, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send us an email at smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. My first question is, it's pretty much math related, numbers related, in that when we've seen the number of diseases caused by these bites from ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas that have tripled over that 12-year period, 2004 to 2016, that obviously means there are a lot more of them. And the question is, why?
Well, there's a lot in the environment that's changing. In relation to ticks, it's kind of a complicated life cycle, but a lot of the development and sprawl that we have going on in Pennsylvania and many other parts of the country are changing the diversity of those communities. When they were farmlands, you actually had predators of rodents. Hunting was allowed. But when you convert that to a development, you lose all the predators. There's no more hunting. So then the tick and the components of Lyme disease are in everyone's backyard.
Or if you take a wooded area and you fragment it and drop houses into it and still leave, you know, a tree line or a wooded area, you've kind of produced these sort of animal refuges so that they can still travel. I mean, the hosts for Lyme disease and for ticks, the small mammals and larger ones like deer. And now you've got people in the mix and everything's in close contact with each other.
You said smaller mammals or deer, and I'm going to, you know, ask questions, jump around here. These ticks in particular are deer, and I understand mice are two of the biggest host animals for ticks.
Yeah, the tick that carries Lyme disease is the black-legged tick. That's the common name. Still one of the other common names that most people call it by is the deer tick. And their hosts, particularly as nymphs, which are the immature stages, are small mammals like mice, voles, chipmunks, small birds, and then they, as they kind of mature, you know, can use deer as a host. But also, anytime in that mix, whether they're immature or adult ticks, you can have humans involved too.
I'm reading a book right now. In fact, I'm interviewing the author of the book about Lyme disease next Wednesday, and in this book, the author describes just animals that are infested, hundreds, thousands of ticks. It seems hard to even imagine, but is that the case here even in Pennsylvania?
Even in Pennsylvania, with some of the research that the Game Commission has done at deer stations where they're checking what hunters get, they can find easily hundreds of ticks on one individual deer. And so larger animals are going to be more susceptible. Even in the agricultural community, people who have horses, it's a concern for them also.
It would sound as if, I mean, these are vector insects, and they prey upon blood. They're looking for blood. That anything out there, any mammal out there, that could be a potential host, correct?
Well, they could be, but it comes down to opportunity and the size of the ticks. So when they're very young, they're very small. And the first thing they're going to come into contact with is usually a small rodent, in many cases the white-footed mouse, which is the primary carrier of the Lyme disease bacteria.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about the life cycle of a tick. And we'll talk about mosquitoes a little bit later, but the life cycle of a black-legged tick, as they are described here in Pennsylvania, how, you know, from birth to death in between, what's life like? You probably never asked that question that way. You
know? Ticks are arthropods. They're arachnids, so they're related to spiders and mites, but they are insect relatives too. And for most of the black-legged ticks, it's like a two-year life cycle to go from an egg to a reproductive adult. So during that time, you primarily have adults that overwinter, and then you have either some retention of blood or some winter feeding, and then there's egg deposit. And egg deposit for ticks is in leaf litter on the ground. And then when those nymphs first hatch out, that's, you know, as Tom had mentioned, they're small, and so what they come in contact with first are just small animals. But then as they mature, you know, they can kind of move on up. But it is going to take an extended period of time for, you know, one adult to be formed. It's not like mosquitoes and some other insects where you can go through, you know, just massive numbers can build up over the course of, you know, a summer because you have multiple generations per year.
What do they feed on?
Ticks or?
Yes, ticks.
Solely blood feeders.
Mm-hmm. So it's just blood.
Yeah, and females really need to take a blood meal because they're using the protein in blood to produce the highest number of viable eggs that will hatch it later. Same thing with, you know, Tom is much more versed in mosquito work. You know, female mosquitoes need to do the same thing.
Where does Lyme come in?
They aren't born with Lyme disease. They feed on the reservoir hosts that have it, and that's a lot of the small animals we have around here. Though I think I read one report that it's somewhere around 25% of the black-legged ticks are actually carrying pathogen, you know, like the Lyme disease bacteria. So it's not like every tick that you encounter, whether it's the black-legged tick or the other common tick that we have in this area is the American brown dog tick, which is larger, which luckily for me, the most of the times I encounter ticks on me, it's the dog tick.
How often do you encounter ticks?
I spend a lot of time outside in tick habitat, and I pull a few of them off me every year. These aren't even feeding, immatures or adults. They're just crawling on me, and I just catch them and take them off. So I would not discourage people from going and spending time outside. I mean, that's one of the beauties of living in Pennsylvania. We have a large amount of state land set aside for parks. And even, you know, in this area here where it's sort of a bit urban around Harrisburg down to the York Corridor, there's still a lot of places to go outside. So I would not discourage anyone from spending time outside.
Did you check yourself before you came in here today?
Did not, because I was not. I was on a tractor yesterday, so I was good.
I'm joking with you.
But that's the big. That's the, one of the big things is if you do spend time outside, no matter if you use repellents and the other things you can do, but to do a tick check when you come in.
Almost every time.
Yeah, it's got to become a habit.
Yeah. You mentioned dogs. We had a listener ask a question about Lyme treatment for dogs. And I have heard people that have said, oh, my dog has Lyme disease, that apparently this is something that's widespread in Pennsylvania as well. So tick bites dog gets Lyme disease. Can dog spread? I don't know whether you can answer that question about treatment for dogs, but still, can the dog spread it to the humans unless it's through a tick?
No, there's no human-human transfer
or no saliva or anything like that.
Yeah, it's all tick vectored.
Mm-hmm. But do you know of treatment for dogs?
There is a treatment and a vaccine that people can get for prevention. I've heard different stories whether or not they're effective long term or not. So that's where people need to have that relationship with their veterinarian.
Now, this vaccine you're talking about for dogs.
Yes, correct.
Is there a vaccine for humans?
Not at this time.
Not at this time. No. So it's pretty much you just have to be careful what you're doing, take precautions ahead of time. Now, Tim, you said something that's interesting. You said that you have found ticks crawling on your body, mm-hmm. but not feeding. What happens if you do find one that, and we've all seen those ticks that are on the skin or under the skin and all that. I mean, is the tick then, should you keep the tick to have it tested for Lyme or just what?
If you do find a tick on you that's embedded its mouth parts and it's started to feed, if it's like the black-legged tick, they need to feed for a number of hours. I mean, originally it was thought to be over 24. Now, some other literature I've read, they need to feed for about 36 to 48 hours to transmit. But if you know it, if you see one on you, I mean, you want to get it off. So the easiest way to get them off is get a pair of fine tweezers and just kind of slide the tips of the tweezers down where you're kind of pushing into your skin and then kind of pinch with the tweezers and then just in a nice smooth quick motion just yank straight up and that'll pull the tick out. You can't really grab them from the back end or the middle or use like, you know, people use a match or something to try to burn them out or Vaseline. All that's going to do is irritate the tick and they'll, you know, lack of a better word, kind of regurgitate more of the blood meal back in and the pathogen. So you need to remove the head capsule, which has the salivary glands. And the mouth parts for ticks are sort of fishhook-like. If you looked at them under an electron microscope, they go in, but they anchor. And that's why if you just try to pull it out, it's not probably going to come right out.
What do you do with the tick if it's still alive once it's been removed? Because you mentioned matches as a kid. I remember all the time, you get that tick, you burn the tick.
I can't speak for all the medical community. I mean, you might be able to take it to a doctor to get identification to see what species of tick it is. You could bring it to an county extension office. You know, if you're in the York County office, you know, or near York, you can bring it to us. You know, Tom and I can look at it if we're in to identify
it. But I guess I'm talking about if you don't want to do that, you just want to kill it.
You can just, they're hard to crush, but you can just, you know, use the tweezers and crush them. You know, people flush them down the toilet. I'm like, well, that's kind of a waste of water. Yeah. You know, just there's other ways you can destroy them.
But yep. With some of the other programs in the state, Dare to be Tick Aware, they're actually recommending that you put the tick in a Ziploc bag and seal it up. And you can put it in the trash that way if you don't need to save it. At the same time, it's good to save it just for going to the physician just to say, yes, this is the tick that bit me. It's still going to take a while for symptoms to show up, so you'd probably have to monitor for that first, but at least you have the proof of the tick.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Carol in Camp Hill. Carol, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm so happy you're doing this subject today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, so here is my little piece of advice for people out there. There is one predator for rodents that there has been an absolute genocide for thousands of years that people are not aware of, and it's snakes. People have been brought up to be scared to death of snakes, and the truth of the matter is almost all of them are harmless, and they are great predators for rodents.
You're my new best friend. I love snakes.
Well, I'll tell you, it started for me about 3 or so months back when I don't know why, out of nowhere, I decided to learn what a copperhead looks like. And so I found this group on Facebook called Snake Identification Group. And who they are, I encourage everybody, please look at this page. Look at this group. It's a group of herpetologists, snake experts, who their mission, it's a public service, and their mission is for anybody can post a picture of any snake, dead or alive, anywhere around the world, and they will give you a positive ID on that snake within like a minute or two. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell you if it's venomous, if it's harmless and beneficial, which almost all of them are. Mm-hmm. And I just encourage everybody to please go to that page, because now they're believing now that back in the medieval ages, when there was the Black Plague, the Black Death going around, and they're believing now that it wouldn't have been nearly so bad if they weren't killing the snakes. Mm-hmm. But the snakes were believed to be so bad. Yeah. You know, I mean, even in the Bible, it's all snakes' fault,
it's
right?
It's all the fault of the snake.
It's thank all you. The snakes' fault. You know, an insult to call somebody is a snake.
That's right. Hey, Carol,
seriously, or like getting into politics, per se, might be called getting into the snake pit.
Yep, you got them.
It's... snake is a bad connotation, but they are such a gift to have around.
Hey, well, thank you very much for your call. The point she makes, now there's a couple different ways to look at that, but it does go back to what you were saying earlier, that there are few natural predators for these animals and for ticks, for the insects that are carrying this disease.
Yeah, so before, when it was a farmland area, you would have had foxes running around, barn owls, snakes, all kinds of predators in that environment, keeping the rodent population in check. But again, once it's a development, we have forested, fragmented areas, those predators can't survive.
But the other point she made, and I don't know whether society will change their
perspective
snakes. You see a snake in the house, and she's right. Not in the house, but even in the yard, that most people look at it and say, ooh, even if they're not poisonous, they don't want a snake around. And, you know, with fewer snakes, obviously, they're still going to be for mice.
More rodents, yes, that is correct.
Absolutely. We're going to talk more about mosquito bites in just a few minutes. We'll continue to take your phone calls about ticks and Lyme disease as what we can answer in the rest of the program. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guests today, Tim Abbey and Tom Smith, we're talking about, they're both from Penn State, York, extension agents. They have longer titles than that. Tim's an extension educator, and Tom Smith is a mosquito surveillance and control, pesticide education, community and citizen engagement. We're taking your calls, talking about tick bites, mosquito bites, and fleas. I have a question about fleas here in just a few minutes. The CDC said earlier this month that disease spread by those three insects have tripled. Diseases have spread between 2004 and 2016. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We did get an email here, Tim, that I wanted to direct to you because you brought this up a little bit earlier. A listener says, sorry, I may not have heard this, but why is it important to find ticks as soon as possible? If they've bit you, doesn't that mean you're possibly already doomed?
Well, doomed is a strong word.
It is a strong word.
No, it depends. If it's the black-legged tick, which is the Lyme disease carrier, you have, a minimum 24 hours before they will transmit the pathogen. So if, you're out one day and you come back that night and you're getting ready to take a shower or bath and you notice this tick on you and remove it, your chances of getting it are pretty minuscule. You can still keep a self-check in your head to monitor for the various symptoms of Lyme disease early onset, because if you get some of the sort of headache, fatigue kind of things and get treated early on, that your chances of a full recovery are better. If it's the American brown dog tick that you find on there, that is not a Lyme disease transmitter. Other parts of the country, it does transmit some other pathogens, so it's really just early detection and getting removed.
So we've been talking a lot about ticks. Before we go on to mosquitoes, though, I was a little bit surprised to see fleas included as disease spreaders in this CDC report. What kind of diseases do fleas spread?
In general, here for fleas, it's more the fact of people getting bitten and those bites getting infected.
Ah, okay. So it's not the bite just itself.
Right.
Okay.
Now, further south, Texas and all, there could be other concerns with fleas transmitting diseases.
But like what?
I'm not 100% sure of what those are, but I believe there's some other situations where fleas can transmit other diseases. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tom and I were talking before we came on about the flea component, and I've not read the report that you've referenced, and I was trying to figure out, why is there more flea borne? If they were saying there are pathogens transmitted, why is there an increase? I mean, the big disease that fleas were known for was, Tom had mentioned the Black Plague, swept through Europe in the 1600s or 17, whenever that was. A flea vectored pathogen.
Does that still exist some places?
Does, yes.
Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Is it bubonic plague?
I think the more common name for it.
Yeah. The thing that's concerning about that is, you say, like in Texas, some of the southern states, that maybe that's a concern, is the way people travel. That, who knows, you know, maybe a family brings a pet to Pennsylvania from Texas and it's brought here.
Right. Anything can be anywhere now within 24 hours.
Well, that is my, leads into, it's my segue into mosquitoes. Because as the CDC report said, there were more diseases spread in those years, that 12-year period, by mosquitoes as well. Now, some of the diseases that we're familiar with, West Nile, which is your specialty in trying to control West Nile here in Pennsylvania, but of course the Zika virus was something that I guess was 2 years ago now that made its way from Latin America into the United States. So those were people who traveled, bitten by a mosquito, came back to the United States, and then was transferred sexually, transmitted sexually. So can that happen with the fleas, maybe?
You would really have to do some other research to see.
I don't want to ask you questions. I'm asking you to speculate. Well, let's talk about mosquitoes. So, as I mentioned, Tom, West Nile is your specialty. Where do we stand with that right now? Because it just seems like we haven't heard a whole lot about West Nile in the last couple of years.
Right, and some of it was because of the situation with Zika and all the fear and the babies being born with small heads, microcephaly. So people put a lot of effort and trying to become more aware of Zika. West Nile is always here in the environment. What people don't realize is it is a bird virus. So all the birds that are migrating through, our resident birds that are here year-round, can be infected with West Nile. And we have certain species of mosquitoes that prefer to feed on birds, and then that's when they pick up the virus, and then looking for a future blood meal is when they can transmit it to humans.
So, as I said, West Nile is you're part of the program to control West Nile. So, what's being done right now?
Well, for us, we're here to protect public health, doing surveillance and response to what we're detecting. So, we actually do trapping throughout York County, and there's mosquito surveillance throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that's being done. And then all those traps that we collect, all the samples are tested for disease. All those areas that we're going into doing surveillance, we're looking for sources of stagnant water, trying to eliminate anything that we can turn over, empty out, and then other sources that may be too large, we can't empty the water out, and they're a mosquito concern, then we're using pesticides.
So I mentioned in the introduction, everyone is well aware of this, the rain that we've had over the past 3 weeks. What kind of impact?
Oh, tremendous impact, especially now with the warmer temperatures, because mosquitoes laying their eggs now from just 10 mosquitoes today, 2 weeks from now, from that one source, you have over 250,000 mosquitoes. So with the fact that there's water everywhere, and it's not just collecting in containers, we have a lot of different areas where people have been going out and mowing, the ground's wet, they're creating ruts, creating additional mosquito breeding habitat.
You brought something along with you today you wanted to talk about.
I did, yes. This is a product that's called Mosquito Dunks. It's a naturally occurring bacteria that works as a pesticide against mosquito larvae, and it's safe for all other animals, wildlife. So if people have some sort of container, a rain barrel, or something that is holding water and it's producing mosquitoes, they can use this. It will last for 30 days, and it's safe for everything else in the environment.
So a couple more questions before we take some phone calls here. Tom, when talking about mosquitoes, what can people do? You kind of suggested some things, but just to kind of reiterate how people can prepare and protect themselves against mosquitoes.
Yes, the best thing people can do first is to inspect their own properties, make sure they don't have anything that's collecting and holding water. So that can be from a tire or a bucket behind a shed, to even the corrugated flexible pipe that people have on their downspouts. Mm. All those hold water and produce mosquitoes. Then after doing that, it's definitely making sure you're dressing properly, light-colored clothing, long pants, long sleeves, and wearing some sort of insect repellent.
Okay, what kind of insect?
There's a lot of different insect repellents out there. We still recommend DEET. There's Picaridin. There are several others. I know people may have an interest in some of the natural repellents. They need to be aware of the fact that a lot of those have not necessarily been tested by the CDC and EPA for effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. So, Tim, what about ticks? And you know, we're getting a lot of calls about this. And I just want to be, before you answer that question, Tim, a lot of these questions about Lyme disease and ticks, I don't think our guests are in a good position to answer when it comes to testing for tick bites and you know, this is some of the symptoms of Lyme disease. We have a guest on next Wednesday, has written a book about Lyme disease that probably could answer these questions, the book from her research in the book. So I encourage you to call next Wednesday or to listen next Wednesday. So Tim, getting back to protecting yourself against ticks.
Go quick. So the best way to prevent is contact. So the areas where you're going to find ticks in the highest occurrence would be leaf litter, which is like, you know, if you're walking through the woods off of a trail, you know, being on the trail is going to be less chance you're going to come into contact with them. But if you go off trail, that can be an issue. Or if you're transitioning from, you know, like a turf mowed manicured lawn to that area where you're getting into a wood line where you have grass that's grown up a little taller, or there's some other, you know, weedy material there, ticks like to crawl up and then kind of anchor themselves and wait for something to come by, and then they catch them with their front pair of legs. So that, knowing where there's a high incidence of ticks, and as Tom mentioned, DEET and Picaridin are two, you know, common repellents. You can also do the, you know, long pants, tucking your pant legs into your socks if you're doing any hiking. Having said that, I don't do any of that.
No, I just see how you have shorts on today.
When it's warm out, I have shorts on. I don't ever use any repellents. If I'm in areas where mosquitoes are bad, I do. But for ticks, I typically don't. So it's like, you know, do as I say, not as I do type of thing.
Yeah, you're a bad example, Tim.
Yeah.
It's a case where you always have to be aware of your surroundings and checking yourself. Another recommendation for the repellents is actually using a product with permethrin. A lot of research has indicated that using that, just spraying that on your shoes and your pants legs, will greatly reduce ticks getting on you.
We had a couple of questions. I'm not going to have time to get to these because, again, I encourage you that have specific questions about Lyme disease to tune in next Wednesday and ask those questions as well. Someone asked if chipmunks are a carrier.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Someone else asked, said her husband mows the grass but comes into contact with leaves and branches, that kind of thing.
You're not going to find ticks up on branches. I mean, ticks don't really run. They don't jump. They don't climb trees and dive bomb out of the trees.
Well, that's good.
You know, they're slow moving and they're down low in the, you know, vegetation profile. So that's the area that they've got to watch.
Are there parts of the human body that they are more likely to feed on?
For the black-legged tick, they're pretty opportunistic. And take the human body and break it up. They're like on a pie chart. They'll feed pretty much everywhere. The American brown dog tick, the predominance is to go up either like under your arms or the base of your neck where there's hair, kind of like that.
What about dogs? Because often you find a tick in a dog's ears or some other places. Its back end.
Yeah, same with, like, you know, Tom had mentioned the deer and other things that get them. That's where a lot of times you find them, is behind the ear, because it's also harder for them to, the animal, to get them off.
Right. And real quick, I want to mention something about dogs, because research indicates that people have a higher risk of Lyme disease if they let their dog sleep in bed with them.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Because ticks are getting off the dog onto the people.
Yeah, well, you've just changed the sleeping habits of thousands of people out there.
Probably not, but...
I know. Tom Smith and Tim Abbey, Penn State, York, thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Are you one of the millions of people who have submitted DNA to companies like Ancestry.com or 23andMe to get information on where your family came from or your ethnic background? With aggressive marketing and advertising, more and more people are providing a saliva sample in a tube and sending it off, only to find out a few weeks later whether what they've always heard is true or what they suspected was true. How accurate are these tests, and what can we learn from them? Our guest today teaches courses on these kind of DNA tests. Darvin Martin is an analytical chemist who teaches classes on DNA tests for Lancaster Mennonite Historical Society's their genealogy conference. Mr. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
This is a fascinating topic, and I know that there probably are a lot of people who have questions about it. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I'll start with the big question. How accurate are these tests?
Well, they are very accurate. In fact, you can prove how accurate they are just based on taking the test with different companies, as long as you're taking the same type of test. There are three different types of DNA, so you have to be aware of the type of test that you're going to take. There's Y chromosomal DNA that's just for males. There's mitochondrial DNA that's for females and males that follows the mother's line. And then there's autosomal DNA that looks at relatives across all your chromosomes.
Mm-hmm. So how does that DNA, the data that they have, how are they able to tell? And it's not specific countries, by the way. There are people who say, well, they can't tell you're from France or you're from Russia or anything like that. It basically, the results come back for a region of the world. How can they make that correspondence?
So that's ethnicity. And that has happened over the last 15 years. Particularly National Geographic has gone around the world, has tested various populations genetically around the world. And genetically, they have particular markers in those populations. So these databases that the testing companies are using utilize those markers to determine your ethnic profile. So you'll see, like with an Ancestry.com test, maybe you're 50% British Isles and 25% Mediterranean Europe, and maybe there's a little Middle Eastern component to it, or a Native American component, or an African component. That all comes from these ethnic markers that have been tested around the world.
So I'll start off with the people who have questioned the accuracy of them. I read a story, I think it was well publicized, of two sisters who submitted DNA, and it came back that they were, you know, different DNA, different ethnicities for the two of them. How does that happen?
So that can happen because each of us is a composite 50% from each parent. But the 50% that we get from each parent would be different than the 50% say my brother or sister would get from my parents. So you can have some differences because perhaps you have in your ancestry, maybe you have a Scottish component, but your sister gets more of that Scottish component than perhaps you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, then again, then I ask the basic question, how accurate if it's, you know, you have the same parents, you're supposed to have the same genetic makeup, why would the test show? I mean, you just explained it, but I think this is hard for a lot of people to understand.
You don't get all the DNA from your parents in you. You get half from each parent. Mm-hmm. So the half that you're getting is somewhat different than the half that a brother or sister is getting. So mm-hmm. This is the reason why brothers and sisters, unless they're identical twins. If they're identical twins, then it will be the same. Mm-hmm. But if they're not identical twins, there will be differences. And this is why we look different. We have some similarities to our brothers and sisters in terms of our physical mm-hmm. features.
That's good analogy.
But we have differences, and those differences are because of our DNA.
Mm-hmm. If you have questions or comments about the DNA test and what you can learn, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. 1-800-729-7532. We have about 15 minutes left in the program. Good opportunity to ask questions about a fascinating topic. There seems to be a lot of people. I mentioned the marketing and the advertising. That's one part of that. There have been a number of TV shows where, you know, Who Do You Think You Are on PBS. We have a show that follows along, uses DNA and Ancestry.com for a lot of the information. Seems to be more and more people who are interested.
Yes. I mean, it's a fascinating project because this is a way that people can trace their family histories back further than the paper trail. So we have, you know, records, cemetery records or Bible records or tax lists and things like that. But with DNA, we're using our own bodies to actually extend those records back into time. Now, we won't necessarily know, say, 500 years ago, the exact name of an ancestor. But because of this ethnic profile that the DNA shows us, we could determine where that ancestor lived. And using a combination of social history and align with where that ancestor lived, perhaps getting some idea of who that ancestor was and what issues they had to deal with in the time that they lived, which is fascinating for people.
All right. So what about the genetics having to do with health? I don't think Ancestry.com does this. Maybe they do, but I'm not aware of it. I know 23andMe does offer a service where you can actually get some information on your genetics of, you know, whether you're predisposed to, you know, maybe Alzheimer's or heart disease or, you know, some other things as well. What do they look at there?
Yeah, so there are certainly markers that you can look at to determine some predispositions towards certain health characteristics or not. And 23andMe has, since its founding, been a type of specialty company that looks into this. So if you are interested in the health aspects, particularly genetic health, if you have certain features, health features that run through your family, and you want to determine whether you also are genetically predisposed towards those features, you should take the 23andMe test. And they follow a whole gamut of situations related to genetics, as it relates to health, all kinds of things. I mean, the topics are almost endless as to what you could look into.
Let's take a call from Allie in East Berlin. Allie, you're on the air. Hello, Allie. You're there. Allie, listen to the phone rather than the radio. We have a delay system. Allie. All right. Well, I'm going to put Allie on hold again. And 8 seconds later, she'll hear what I just said to her and on the radio. And then she'll say, oh, okay. So we'll take her call in just a moment. But let's see. We had a listener send in an email. Just a comment says, I did not know who my father was, so I used Ancestry DNA to determine what my full heritage is. While I cannot speak to the accuracy of the test as far as heritage, I was matched with my father. He did not know I existed. We've begun to develop a relationship that should have started over 50 years ago.
Wow. I mean, those are amazing stories that can come out of this. This is why people end up taking DNA tests, to find this kind of information.
See, the thing that there's surprises, and you hear, all right, so I'm going to tell my personal story here. Christmas, it was a Christmas gift, by the way, my Ancestry.com. So Lamar, capital M, French. All these years, thought French was the dominant ethnic background. Of course, it doesn't say France. It comes back as Western Europe. Anyway, comes back 55% Great Britain, 16% Ireland or Scotland, and way down the list, like about 5% Western Europe. So,
okay.
Now, this is a total surprise. What can you tell me about that total surprise?
Yeah, so this often happens. And let's start off. Lamar is only a small piece of your family, Scott.
That, I know.
You know, because
know.
It's looking at all your branches. So you have 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents. Those could have all kinds of different ethnicities, mostly European probably, but all kinds of different ethnicities. So you may be a lot British Isles. But you also, in addition to that, you have to look at migrations over time. And we have, I have Swiss ancestry.
I was going to ask about yours. Yeah.
And a lot of people that have Swiss ancestry, they end up aligning with the British Isles because of the Celtic populations in ancient Europe. During Roman times, Celts began in Alpine Europe, in the area of Eastern France, Switzerland, Austria, but many of them moved to the British Isles. Now, my ancestors stayed in Switzerland, but those relatives of my ancestors that were Celtic moved to the British Isles. So I end up having matches with people in Wales and Scotland and Ireland because of that. But that's 2,000 years ago.
Now, how do you know that? How did you know that there was that movement?
I mean, that movement is known in social history. Okay. Archaeologists have known that for a long, long time, well over 100 years, that the Hallstatt culture in Austria has pottery and burial practices and such very similar to the Gaelic cultures in Ireland and in Scotland. And so they've connected those things together. And even from Roman records and such, the languages that were spoken in Switzerland and Austria during the time of the Roman Empire were very similar to the languages that were spoken in Ireland.
So my sister is convinced that our Great Britain, Irish, Scotland, that there's Viking there. So.
Oh, yeah. Almost certainly. Because if you have Irish ancestry, you go back 1,000 years, there were Vikings in Ireland. So almost certainly the Vikings would be your ancestors. In fact, statistically, it has to be. Because you go back, if you go back 10 generations, you have 1,000 ancestors. There's 1,024, but there's probably a little bit of overlap. You go back 20 generations, it's 1,000,000 ancestors. 30 generations, which is about 1,000 years ago, 1,000,000,000 ancestors, more than the population of the world. Statistically, you must have Vikings as your ancestors if you have Irish ancestors.
So, yeah, I was joking, but my sister is going to be thrilled to hear that there's Viking in us. Allie is back on the line. Yeah. Allie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Go
there
right ahead.
There was some inconsistency there in the beginning, first time.
That's okay.
Okay, number one. Can you recommend a time for you to spit into that little funnel? Is there a better time, say morning versus evening? And number two, I had this packet since Christmas and I forgot about it.
Oh,
I know. There's so much on my plate.
I know.
But anyway.
Okay.
I didn't open it up or anything. So is it still feasible? I am registered.
Yes, the packets do not expire. In fact,
okay,
I've bought several over the years, and I've held one for 2 or 3 years, and then had somebody that wanted to test, so I gave it to them, and it was still viable. So there's no issue with the packets expiring.
Okay.
The best time to take the test, in terms of time of day and such, you want to make sure you have a clean mouth. Like, you don't want to eat something and then take the test right after you eat something. So
Okay.
In the morning, after you brush your teeth is good. Maybe before you eat breakfast, that type of thing. Any time that as long as it's an hour or two after you've eaten something.
So no hot peppers, okay. And then spitting in the tube.
And the only reason for that is that they're separating out your DNA from all the other DNA in your mouth, right? So it just makes it easier for them to separate out your particular DNA.
Hey, Allie, thank you.
I have another question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Real quick.
Go ahead.
How can you alleviate the bubbles in the saliva? That's another thing. They're saying no bubbles. I tried it separately. It was like, how can I alleviate bubbles?
The reason they say that is they want to have as much of your saliva as possible. And if you fill up the tube with bubbles, then there's not as much saliva there.
Yeah, I see your point. Okay.
So look at it
in that way.
Thank you very much for your call. Yeah, I spent Christmas morning spitting into a tube as the whole family watched. And But it was a gift, you know? So let's take a call from Mike in Camp Hill. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
Good. Listen, I knew you guys had kind of touched upon this before, but I just wanted to make sure I understood it clearly. If I had a parent from one ethnicity and a parent from different ethnicity, would I be exactly half of each? Or is there a possibility as a male that I would get a little bit more from my father's ethnicity?
So the reality is that your parents, you say that they're from a specific ethnicity, but when you go back more and more generations, that ethnicity is probably blended with other ethnicities. So let's say, you know, your mother is Greek and your father is Irish. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a 50-50 composite of each of those ethnicities in your DNA profile, because when you go back further in time, perhaps that Greek has some Polish or Bulgarian or Italian within it, and perhaps that Irish has some French or German. So there is a blending of these ethnicities as you go back through time.
Okay, but let's just make an assumption theoretically here that they were a little bit, there was not a lot of mixing that went on. Okay. Would I be right down the line, 50% each, or?
It would be very close to 50% each.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much for your call. Let's take a call from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I did Ancestry, and I got results that blew me away. And you just touched on a comment about Vikings that I would like some clarification on, okay? My father's whole entire side of the family is German. We did the actual legwork and paperwork to trace it back to 1605 in Germany, okay? My mother's side had a great-grandfather from Denmark, and a great-grandmother whose source was in Ireland. Now, when I got my results, I got nothing to relate to Germany or Germanic or anything, but my largest percentage was Scandinavian. And I don't know whether the Germanic overlaps with Viking or whether this little tiny Denmark relative, great-grandfather from Denmark, is the source of this huge proportion.
Very good question. And often there are surprises like this in these ethnic profiles. So I'm going to assume, just based on what you're saying, that your German component is northern Germany, perhaps around Hamburg, that area, so that the Viking or the Scandinavian piece of that is included there in the blending. Possibly your ancestors 1,000 years ago came from Scandinavia and then migrated down into Germany across the Baltic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I have the Irish component, which you just mentioned, how Vikings were in Ireland thousands and thousands of years ago. So that could be a supplemental type of thing for that.
1,000 years ago.
Hey, yeah. Susan, we're Vikings. You know, we're related somehow.
I know. I told my husband, you're not married to a German. You're married to Viking girl.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. We're going to have a bunch of people wearing those little helmets with the horns out the side.
Just to say, I mean, these surprises are something that DNA testing companies now promote. You see on TV that it's the surprise. Yeah. You take your test and you see what the surprise is in your results.
We have some questions via email. What if that group was taken over by other countries? Will that group still exist within those countries and be identified as their true identity?
Yes, that's a very interesting question because, you know, as cultures change and get assimilated into other cultures, what actually happens? I mean, in many cases, there is a blending. So I actually have some Native American ancestry because of
everybody
that.
Says they do.
I didn't know I had until I got tested.
Okay.
You know, and then we figured it out.
Oh, no, I'm not doubting you, but I'm just saying that that's one of the things.
Right.
There are so many Americans who think that they do have some Native American ancestry and find out they really don't.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that does happen, you know. So yeah, I mean, it is an interest for people, too, whether they have Native ancestry or not. And I always say, and this is a thing, too, that's very important. If you test and it shows Native ancestry, then you know that you have Native ancestry. But if you test and it doesn't show it, you don't necessarily don't know, because your Native ancestry could be one tiny component 10 generations ago, and it gets diluted out.
Uh-huh.
The algorithms that they use for the DNA possibly could dilute out a Native component if it's 3 centuries ago or 2.5 centuries ago.
This is a question I'm sure a lot of people have. Could you please ask the following question? I'm very interested in having my DNA tested, but I have concerns about making my DNA available to business that could sell it to another company, including an insurance company that might use it as the basis to exclude people from coverage for pre-existing conditions. What are your thoughts on privacy as it relates to racial profiling?
This is a very important question these days, and especially with the criminal activity and such and using DNA to solve crimes and things like that, which is all a good thing, but we're all concerned about privacy. So what I suggest is that you go with the established companies, either 23andMe, Ancestry.com, or FamilyTreeDNA, because they all have they all have guidelines and strict regulations in regards to how the DNA is used. If you take your raw DNA and then send it to a third-party site, then you really have no control over that DNA.
So Ancestry and 23andMe are two reputable?
Yes, okay. And then Family Tree DNA as well.
Okay, and somebody asked us a similar question asking whether they'll protect your DNA results, and I think you just answered that question. Darvin Martin, thank you very much for being with us today. Obviously, we have a lot of interest. Can we have you back?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. Coming up on it's Tuesday's program. Forgot we have a three-day weekend. No Smart Talk on Monday. Coming up on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about UN peacekeeping. That's coming up on Tuesday's Smart Talk. Have a good holiday weekend.